Hello and welcome to Mail Call, a podcast of news, letters, and stories from the Great War. Starting off, let's go back 100 years to June 1914, just before the start of the Great War. We have two excerpts from the Chicago Ledger, a newspaper printed on June 20th, 1914. We have a short excerpt from a story called Warship Adventures, and we have a timely word from our sponsors.
Warship Adventures, or Frank Allen at Sea, by Julian Faber. Chapter 2. "Hey, Frank, shore liberty," sang out Walt Marsden. Dressed in their white uniforms, the two friends started for the streets of Old Newport. Marsden was Frank's buddy, as the apprentice seaman calls his boon companion, and since shore leave extended from 1 o'clock until 11 in the evening on each alternate day, the two young men found plenty of time for amusement. In fact, only one thing proved irksome. There was a shortage of cash, for Uncle Sam requires that every apprentice seaman accumulate 2 months' pay to his credit as soon as possible. Nevertheless, what with sightseeing, the chaplain's entertainment on Saturday nights, the Monday evening concert and moving pictures at the station, and every form of athletic diversion, this temporary lack of spending money was not severely felt. And there was something inspiring in the thought that one's earnings were come by without the humiliations incidental to civil life. There was no going, cap in hand, to petition for a job. Frank owed no man gratitude for his pleasures or for his living, either. Upon the farm, he had felt that every mouthful of food he ate was paid for by his father. Never had Frank Allen dreamed of the new life that was to unfold for him as soon as he entered the gates of the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Events had so crowded one upon another that the whole thing seemed like a dream, but a very happy one. And so far, he had not experienced anything in the remotest degree resembling Uncle Jed's stories. Frank tried to recall the separate events that had occurred since his enlistment. First and foremost, there was the astonishing difficulty about enlisting. The people at the recruiting office were extremely inquisitive, and at times disconcerting, before they agreed to let him sign a 4 years contract with Uncle Sam. They wanted to know if he had his parents' permission, or if he were 18. And then, after all, he had to give a reference in his native town, showing that he was of good character. He had given the name of the clergyman, and the clergyman had written at once and warmly commended him. Frank had awaited the letter with little hope, and he was amazed at its cordiality, for he did not know what the pastor realized, that he was really a very good sort of average boy, merely spoiling for want of congenial occupation, and by no means the particular black sheep that he imagined himself to be. Then the doctors had thumped and pummeled him, and listened to his lungs and heart, and looked at his feet and investigated his teeth, as though he were a horse. They inspected his arms and legs to see that each pair matched, and they showed him skeins of colored wool. Confusion colors, he heard the doctors call them, and seemed in a conspiracy to compel him to admit that green was brown. Finally, they made him take the oath of allegiance and also swear that he had never suffered from fits. After this, they shipped him off to the training station at Newport, and there the whole process was gone through again. They gave him $60 worth of clothing, for which he would have had to pay twice that sum in civil life, complete from uniforms of blue and white, to hammock, mattress, underclothes, socks, shoes, and blacking brushes. They made him bathe and cut his hair, and after all this, they sent him to prison for 3 weeks. But there was no ignominy attached to this sentence, which all must serve who enter the training school. Uncle Sam is solicitous for the health of every nephew of his, and the period in the detention barracks was merely a quarantine against the possibility of any infectious disease developing. There were 4 flats in the detention barracks, each with a living and sleeping room, a galley, and a separate entrance, and in each flat, 28 young men cast longing eyes toward the recruits exercising in the grounds, or racing in cutters and dinghies on the water, and awaited the period of their emancipation. And it was there that Frank Allen and Walt Marsden, two homesick, dispirited, and disconsolate young men, met and liked each other, and formed the friendship which lasted throughout their whole period of service. Yet even in the detention barracks, there was numerous things to be learned and done. The first thing that Frank was taught was to lash his hammock and make his quarters shipshape. He discovered that a hammock with a hair mattress inside is better than the best bed made, and afterward he found that, swinging always to the perpendicular, It gives sleep in a gale, which would send the occupants of berths and beds rolling from side to side. The second thing he learned was to fold his clothes neatly. He found that, when properly folded and tightly rolled and stowed away, a uniform comes out of its bag as neatly pressed as though it had been to the tailor's. And he discovered also, since there is only one way of doing a thing right, that he had to fold his clothes almost exactly as his mother had folded them. This insignificant fact opened his eyes to much that he had not before understood. The 3 weeks soon sped by, and then Frank was one of 2,000 young men, all busy learning the rudiments of seamanship or a trade. Not more than half of Uncle Sam's enlisted men are sailors. Or soldiers, either, for the matter of that. You can join the Navy in an amazingly different number of ways. As a matter of fact, Frank's choice was limited to that of apprentice seaman, which was what he wanted to be, unless he had chosen to be a hospital apprentice, mess attendant, or ship's cook, because the other ratings require a minimum age on enlistment of 21. "Take it from me, there's no job like a ship's cook," said Smiles, a second-class cook aboard the Constellation, an old fellow whose memory went back to that archaic period known as the 70s. "It's all very well to fight the ship, bud, but cooks get the pickings, and there ain't nobody can stop them. But it ain't what it used to be," he continued, shaking his head sorrowfully. "In the old days, they gave you clean water from water kegs, and when you'd skimmed off the scum, it had a taste to it. But since those newfangled notions of distilled water have come into fashion, everything's going to the dogs. They boil your insides with hot coffee, and then they freeze them with ice cream. And a cook's got to know how to make victuals that no sailor man ever heard of in my days. You enlist as a landsman, bud, and they'll send you to the commissary school. You'll be a third-class cook in no time, and by you'll be a second-class cook, drawing your $44 regular and easy. If I had your education, I'd have been a first-class cook years ago. But all food's plain grub to me. I can cook it, but I can't play with it and call it names and tell the examining board why roast beef has gravy instead of applesauce." Frank listened attentively, but he came to the conclusion that he was not out for a cook's job. Good food and a modicum of hard work soon make the recruit's body firm and his skin clear. If Frank Allen could have met himself as he was when he appeared, a month or so before, at the gates of the Brooklyn Navy Yard, he would hardly have known himself. His eye was bright, his slouch was gone, and in place of the cheap country-made suit, he wore a neat uniform. And shade of Uncle Jed, with his hardtack and pickled horse. What would that venerable ghost have said if it could have seen the meat pies, omelets, stewed tomatoes, roast veal and gravy, and ice cream that disappeared down 2,000 hungry throats at mealtimes? Walt Marsden, Frank's buddy, was from Maryland. Unlike Frank, he had chosen a naval career with the full approbation of his parents. His father had served a gun under Farragut and had witnessed the transformation from sails to steam. He knew of the change which had been made in the discipline and personnel of the Navy since the times when a gun crew put up the placard, "English spoken here," in ridicule to the preponderating foreign element in the personnel. Today, 96% are American citizens, and soon 100% will be. Walt Marsden's father was as wise in his selection of a career for his son as thousands of other parents will soon become, and Walt meant to make the Navy his profession.
"Your Declaration of Independence will be signed the instant you put your name on a postcard answering this ad. Get your gun for the 4th of July. We'll show you how one holiday can make you more than enough money to pay for this photo machine that will make you independent for years. 8 cents a minute, $4.80 an hour, $25 or more a day. That's the way the boys behind these guns make 'em hum. The fellows shooting everybody with the diamond postcard gun. Get behind it. It hits big money every time. Get out on the bathing beaches, go to the ballpark, street parades, fairs, carnivals, auto races, aviation meets. Strike it big on the excursion steamers. One day's fun makes the outfit yours. Greatest vacation moneymaker ever imagined. No plates, no films, and no dark rooms. Snap 'em and make 'em right on the spot. Takes 1 minute for fine finished postcards and photo buttons. Costs 2 cents, sell for 10 cents. Put your name on that postcard now. Mail quick. You want the proof. We've got it. Right. That's all. Takes 5 sizes of postcards, including standard size, and swell photo buttons. Complete instructions, 20 minutes to learn, then it's easy money for you. 750 and up. International Metal and Ferro Company, D655, Chicago, Illinois.
Up next from the Clandegal Journal, printed on June 27, 1914, an event invitation for some fun in the park.
Clandegal Games, sanctioned by the AAU, will be held Saturday, July 4, 1914, at Central Park, 4400 North 5th Street. Games commence at 1 p.m. sharp. Prizes are handsome silver cups for first, second, and third places in each event except 5-mile race, for which large cups will be awarded for first place and smaller cups for next four places. 6 gold, silver, and bronze medals will be awarded in boys' race. Special large cup for club scoring the most points in the meet. Entrance fee, 25 cents, dollar for relay team. Send entries and fees to Eugene J. O'Keefe, Irish American Club, Philadelphia. Irish jigs, reels, hornpipes, and figure dancing special medals will be awarded. Handsome Silver Cup prizes. Gaelic football match between the Robert Emmett Club of West Philadelphia and the Shamrock Club of North Philadelphia. Exhibition hurling match between the Wolf Tun Club and the Sarsfield Club. Irish and American dances all day in the pavilion. Irish jigs, reels, and hornpipes dance all day to Irish music on 4 platforms specially erected for that purpose. Admission to the park, 25 cents.
Coming back to the United States, we have an article from June 29th, 1914, printed in The Sun in New York City. This is from page 2, an article on the death of Francis Ferdinand.
Death of Francis Ferdinand makes for peace of Europe. Reactionary at home, aggressive abroad, prospect of elevation caused anxiety. By F. Cunliffe Owen. It is difficult to discuss the tragedy at Sarajevo without laying oneself open to the reproach of heartlessness. For while it is only natural that one should be stricken with horror at the brutal and shocking assassination of Archduke Francis Ferdinand, it is impossible to deny the fact that his disappearance from the scene is calculated to diminish the tenseness of the situation and to make for peace both within and without the dual empire. To such an extent has Francis Ferdinand been regarded both at home and abroad as a disturbing factor and as committed to forceful and extremely aggressive policies that the news of his death is almost calculated to create a feeling of universal relief. For several years past, the emperor, owing to age and infirmity, has associated his nephew and heir apparent with him in the duties of sovereignty. He had been prompted in the matter by his patriotic desire to initiate the archduke to such an extent into the multifarious responsibilities of rulership that when the time came for him to sing his Nunc Dimittis and to lay down his weary head in that wonderful crypt at the Capuchin Church at Vienna, where over 200 of the Habsburgs sleep their last sleep, the succession of the crown might take place without any undue jolt or disturbance of the intricate machinery of the dual empire, with its near score of rival races all antagonistic to one another, and whose principal bond of union is to be found in their affection for that Nestor of European monarchs, Francis Joseph of Austria. The emperor has had several severe illnesses during the last 6 or 7 years. Illnesses which had the effect of vesting in the hands of Francis Ferdinand a far greater degree of power than had ever been intended by his uncle. Once possessed of this power, it was difficult to deprive the Archduke thereof without precipitating one of those open breaks between the sovereign and the heir apparent which have played so important a role in the history of monarchical countries to the detriment of the interests both of the dynasty and of the nation. But what with Ferdinand's ever-increasing usurpation of power and the emperor's quiet and determined efforts to restrain him, a situation was created which frequently proved a cause of great embarrassment of the ministers of the crown and to the commanding officers of the army and navy. During the emperor's illnesses, that is to say, when his restraining hand was relaxed, Francis Ferdinand furnished evidence of a masterfulness which boded ill for the future of Austria and Hungary. It is notorious that he strongly resented and openly disapproved of the concessions which the emperor had made to Hungary with the object of propitiating Magyar sentiment. He looked upon them as dangerous surrenders to the nationalist aspirations of Hungary, as calculated to impair the strength of the dual empire, and conveyed the impression that once on the throne he would stand no nonsense from the Magyars, and would, if necessary, reduce them to the subjection in which they were held prior to the revival of their constitution by Francis Joseph in 1867. Twice, the Archduke brought his country to the very brink of war with Russia, and on three occasions also with Serbia, while 4 years ago he adopted so aggressive a policy toward Italy that hostilities seemed imminent and were only averted by the timely recovery of the emperor from his illness and by his putting the brakes on both the military and political activities of his government. What the motives were which prompted the assassins to murder both Archduke Francis Ferdinand and the Duchess of Hohenberg yesterday can only be a subject of speculation until additional details of the tragedy are received. But it must be remembered that the population of Herzegovina and Bosnia is largely Serb, that the annexation of the two provinces by Austria-Hungary 5 years ago put an end to the nationalist dream of the Serbs for a revival of the old-time empire of Greater Serbia, and that the Serbians in the Kingdom of Serbia, in Herzegovina and Bosnia, and in Croatia have for years past looked upon Archduke Francis Ferdinand with aversion and hatred as the chief foe to all their ideals. Then, too, they, like the Muslim population of the two provinces, cannot forgive the fact that Austria still withholds from them the home rule government and autonomy which they have been led to believe would be conceded to them after being incorporated in the dual empire.
Almost a week later, we find a different perspective on the same subject. This is taken from the Gaelic American, printed on July 4, 1914, another article on the death of Francis Ferdinand.
The double crime at Sarajevo. As yet, the only thing known with certainty in connection with the assassination of the heir to the crowns of Austria-Hungary and his wife at Sarajevo in Bosnia last Saturday is that it was the work of an elaborate conspiracy that can be traced back to Serbia as a revenge for the loss of the port on the Adriatic taken by Serbia during the First Balkan War. It is, in fact, an act of war against Austria for having deprived her of it, though no war has been declared. There are different ways of making war, and this was one of them. Not very long ago, the then Russian minister at Bucharest in Romania, named Hitrovo, in an after-dinner speech, expressed the sentiment that assassination was a weapon not sufficiently employed in political warfare, and was promptly recalled by his government for his want of tact. He was giving things away. At that time, and before and since, the Balkan states have been the scenes of frequent assassinations of kings and political leaders, and by many, the inspiration of them was believed to come from the Pan-Slav party in Russia. The murders of the unfortunate King Alexander of Serbia and his wife were openly stated to have been prompted from there, and the name of the bank through which the funds in aid passed was a matter of public knowledge. The assassination of King George of Greece in Salonika during the late war did not come into the category of political crimes, but the recent bomb outrage at Debrecen in Hungary was traced to the other side of the Russian frontier. A significant thing in connection with this Sarajevo misdeed is that King Peter of Serbia, himself an old conspirator, should have handed over the administration of affairs to his heir and retired from Belgrade to the other extremity of his kingdom only a few days before it happened. Whether he foresaw what was coming and wanted to be out of the way must remain a matter of conjecture. The comments in the New York press, where they are not wide of the mark, betray an inspiration that carries with it the English brand. This is noticeably so in an article in the New York Sun signed by Cunliffe Owen. It is at the risk, as the writer says, of an accusation of heartlessness, the assassin's deed was justified, because forsooth the victim was said to be an of aggressive temperament, and therefore a danger to that peace so dear to the subsidized twattlers of Mr. Andrew Carnegie's staff and the Anglo-Ute gang that is trying to manipulate American opinion in favor of England. What effect this latest political crime will have on the already strained situation in Europe remains to be seen. That it is approved of by the organs of the Triple Entente is in itself a warning of danger.
Looking back now on this article on a very important event leading up to the Great War, it might be surprising to know that this article was buried on page 4 of the Gaelic American. Carrying on with the Gaelic American, we have, from a couple issues later, on July 25th, 1914, this lovely piece from page 3.
Cozy Corner Chat for Women, Children, and the Home. In Ireland, there is a ladies' organization, a kind of women's auxiliary, organized for the purpose of aiding the Irish National Volunteers. It is called Cumann Numann, and it has branches in several of the cities there. The men in charge of the National Volunteers at home have encouraged those patriotic women to organize, knowing the splendid assistance they can give the movement, and the Cumann Numann has already done work which more than justifies the expectations of its founders. In any of the published manifestos of the American committees, national or local, which have been organized to arm the men of Ireland, no invitation seems to have been extended to the women of the race in the United States to lend their assistance in furtherance of the good work. Suggestions have been made that men other than those of Irish birth or descent should be admitted to membership in the committees. Why not invite the women of Irish birth or extraction before seeking the cooperation of those of the male persuasion who don't belong to the Irish race at all? In the Fenian movement, and in the stormiest days of the Land League, Irish women rendered invaluable service to the national cause, and their work for the language revival is known and appreciated by those at the head of the Gaelic League, into whose councils women have been warmly welcomed. The committees established in this country should invite the cooperation of the women. They were never better equipped than they are now to help an Irish national undertaking. Women, as a rule, have more opportunity for reading than the men, particularly young women. Consequently, a very large number of them patronize the public libraries. It is well known to those who have made a study of the matter that it is a difficult thing to get good Irish books in the public libraries. Irish taxpayers, and the women are taxpayers as well as the men, contribute to the maintenance of the libraries. Why, then, shouldn't they have something to say regarding the books which are on the shelves in those places? There is no scarcity of Irish books, either of fiction or the more substantial kind, and the library authorities will order them if the demand is made for them and the librarian is told where they can be procured. In the beginning, the person seeking the book relating to Ireland may have to be a little insistent in order to get it, because the people in charge of the libraries have not been accustomed to many demands of this kind. But persistence will win out. If you want an Irish book, go to a public library and ask for it, and keep on asking until you get it.
Wrapping up our first edition of Mail Call, we have this piece, an exact translation of the first edition of Weltkrieg, the German paper in the World War, called An Accurate Daily Record of the Present War. Here's the first month of events.
On June 28th, the Austro-Hungarian heir apparent, Archduke Francis Ferdinand, and his wife were murdered by Serbian conspirators at Sarajevo in Bosnia. Investigation showed that Serbian army officers and civil officials of high rank participated in the crime, and that it was encouraged in Serbian government circles. On July 23rd, at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, Austria-Hungary sent the Serbian government an ultimatum. The ultimatum demanded an honest investigation, in which the Austrian authorities should take part, of the crime of June 28th, severe punishment of all the guilty, a guarantee that all further agitations in behalf of a greater Serbia and directed against Austria-Hungary cease, and acceptance or rejection of the note within 48 hours. On July 24th, the Serbian mobilization began. The Russian government informed Count Portales, the German ambassador at St. Petersburg, that Russia could not remain indifferent in the settlement of the Serbian question. On July 25th, Russia mobilized on the Austro-Hungarian frontier. At 6 o'clock in the afternoon, the time limit set for Serbia to accept the Austrian ultimatum expired. Serbia gave an entirely unsatisfactory response and arranged for general mobilization. The Austrian-Hungarian minister, Baron Giesel, left Belgrade. A portion of the Austro-Hungarian army was mobilized. On July 26th, Russian mobilization for the governments of Kiev, Odessa, Warsaw, and Moscow were ordered. Emperor William gave up his journey in northern waters, and the German government began an energetic effort at mediation in London, Paris, St. Petersburg, and Vienna. On July 27th, Russia put territory adjacent to Austrian frontier under martial law. The French maneuvers were discontinued. On July 28th, Austria-Hungary declares war on Serbia. The German emperor placed himself in direct telegraph communication with the Tsar in an endeavor to confine the war to Austria-Hungary and Serbia. On July 29th, the chief of the Russian General Staff assured the German military attaché in St. Petersburg that Russia had as yet taken no step towards mobilization. Numerous advices from reliable sources, however, prove the contrary. France and Belgium made military preparation. On July 30th, Prince Henry of Prussia returned from England, where, under instructions from the German Emperor, he had discussed with King George in person the localizing of the war and the maintenance of peace. On July 31st, Russia mobilized her entire military force, whereupon a state of threatened war was declared in Germany. A German note with a time limit addressed to Russia declares that German mobilization will ensue unless Russia, within 12 hours, will put a stop to her military measures against Germany and Austria. At the same time, an inquiry, also with a time limit, was sent to France, asking whether or not the French government would remain neutral in the case of a Russo-German war. Meanwhile, general mobilization was ordered in Austria-Hungary. At noon, Emperor William II arrived in Berlin and was greeted with tremendous demonstrations of loyalty. At 3 o'clock, the emperor delivered the following spirited address to a large and enthusiastic crowd gathered in front of the palace. "Today, a grave crisis has befallen Germany. Those everywhere envious of us are driving us to a just defense. The sword is being forced into our hands. I hope if my efforts do not succeed in bringing our enemies to reason and in preserving peace, we shall, with God's help, wield the sword in such a manner that we may sheathe it again with honor. War would require of the Germans an enormous sacrifice in blood and treasure, but we will show our antagonists what it means to attack us. I commend you to God. Go now into your churches, kneel there before him, and pray for help for our brave army." Russian warships seized the German steamer Prinz Eitel Friedrich on the open sea off Reval. The war has not been declared. The Russian dreadnought Sankt Andreas ran aground off the Russian port of Hango in Finland. Belgium mobilized.
That concludes this installment of Mail Call, a podcast of newsletters and stories from the Great War. Thank you for listening. This episode features the voice talents of Laura Bang, Michael Foyt, Damian Katch, Ramon McBride, Susan Riley Stevens, David Ospel, and myself, Chris Hallberg. Historical documents were accessed through the digital collections of the Digital Library at Villanova University and the Library of Congress. Our theme music is Till We Meet Again, as performed by Nicholas Orlando's Orchestra. The Mail Call podcast is a project of Home Before the Leaves Fall, a Great War Centennial Exposition. For more information, please visit our website at wwionline.org, where you can find more information on how to get your very own
Diamond Postcard Gun!